Those questions are helpful. These interviews, because obviously when I'm teaching, I know exactly what I'm saying. But then when people tell me what I'm saying, I realize they don't know what I'm saying, to some extent. So that's the way of perception. You think you've described something accurately, and then you realize, ooh, I missed that, didn't I? So for a teacher, it's really helpful to get feedback about what works and doesn't work. So appreciate that. One of the things that came up in the interviews was that I probably didn't emphasize it. When I talk about listening, I'm not just thinking about audio. I'm just using listening also as a synonym for awareness beyond the hearing part through sound. So when I suggest listen, then go to the sound first if you want, and then just let go of sound as well. So there's just pure awareness. That's what I'm trying to indicate. So just like looking is used as a synonym for awareness. I'm looking at the way things are. It's also obviously not just visual. It's about awareness. So I think that was helpful for me to know. So the person in the interview said they go to the heart, and then they listen from the heart, and that's what I do too, actually. So that sounds a bit confusing maybe when you're listening from the heart, but if you try it out, I think you get a sense of it. As you develop meditation, I think most meditators find some way of abiding in the present moment which indicates that the mind is not caught up with preoccupations. Part of it is just the letting go of thought. Part of it is having a sign, you could say. So Ajahn Sumedho uses the sound of silence. When he teaches, he talks about the mind relaxed and open, attentive, aware, awake. And then he says when you do that, when you let go, when you're not grasping objects, trying to figure stuff out, your mind relaxes into openness. And you'll hear this background sound, which I mentioned before. And that background sound can be used as a sign of the relaxed, open, empty mind. So I guess I could ask you, do you have any signs, indications in your practice which indicate for you, oh, yeah, this is open, this is relaxed? It might be like bodily feelings, it might be openness in the heart, might be the sound of silence. These are very, very helpful kind of signs. They're very personal usually. And then if you try to reproduce someone else's sign, you might notice it, but then sometimes you're trying to manufacture something that they use, that they find helpful. So the suggestions from teachers are suggestions, but I think the main thing is to begin to understand what letting go is about, what non-grasping is about, non-attachment, what emptiness is about, what is this language pointing to? When we talk about the practice is for relinquishment, for abandonment, for letting go. That's the way we usually talk about it, rather than grasping attainment and trying to get something, because that suggestion, although you read about attainments in the text, that suggestion usually creates a mind which is trying to become and get something. So most teachers will talk about letting go. So rather than trying to get rid of thought, you let go of thought. Rather than trying to get rid of preoccupations, you let go of preoccupations. It's just words, but it indicates something of the methodology of finding the peaceful mind. One of the questions, I'm sorry, I'm not very good at these questions. I look at them and then I end up not answering them, so that's just me. You can ask the questions in the interviews, but I'll try to answer sort of some. But one of the questions there was around, I should have brought it, around the heart being open and then people taking advantage of a person in that way. Being open-hearted, and then people take advantage of that. Well, I think there's also, when I think of Ajahn Chah, he was very open-hearted, but he was fearless. And I think that's an important part of it, that if open-heartedness is also conjoined with fearfulness of some sort, kind of being overly deferential or overly solicitous or obsequious or whatever it is, then that's not necessarily the open heart. So sometimes being kind to others can also be trying to appease others, trying to make sure they're happy, wanting them to like us. And that's not really metta, that's usually based in fear. So the combination of deep compassion and fearlessness is, you know, you get someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, between Ajahn Chah and the Dalai Lama, I mean, I've never met beings who are so radiantly compassionate, and yet you wouldn't mess with them. You know you'd have no entry into their heart to try to play around with them or manipulate them or do anything, because they're just like mountains. There's a great story from, there was one monk, Venerable Titapo, who Ajahn Chah seemed to like the kind of some of the Westerners because we were so eccentric. And if I remember correctly, Venerable Titapo was in a monastery, Bambui, I think it was him, and he, I might have it wrong, but there was a flood in the monastery and he rushed back to his kuti to try to save his tea kettle. He was from England. Imagine there's a flood and you swim back to get your tea kettle. It's pretty outrageous. Anyway, Ajahn Chah would play around with him. And quite often his playing around was a testing, but you were always grateful for the testing because you knew it came from a man who was interested in your well-being. And so we all had that fortune. But Venerable Titapo, I think Ajahn Chah was praising. He was with a group of Thai people and praising the Western monks that they're diligent, da-da-da-da-da-da, they're good practitioners, and he pointed to Titapo, but not this one, this one's really dumb. Just in front of all the Thai people. And then he asked Venerable Titapo, does that make you angry? And Titapo said, what's the point? It'd be like being angry at a mountain. So he could do that because he had great compassion. You just knew it. You just knew that this man had your best interests at heart. But someone else to do that, which was coming from some place of superiority or patronizing, that wouldn't work. It wouldn't work at all. But anyway, the issue of the open heart, it sometimes also gets confused with sentimentality. So the cynic always thinks that metta is sentimentality. Sentimentality, what is that? Oh, I think everything's wonderful. It's kind of sweet and syrupy, and the lamb will lie down with the lion. Actually, the lion eats the lamb. Let's face it, you know, this is nature. So syrupy sentimentality, that's sometimes the cynical person will think that's what it's about. And of course the person doesn't see that the cynical mind creates that. But when you really abide with the open and compassionate heart, it's not sentimental at all. It's quite a beautiful connection with life. And it's very, very powerful. It's very powerful. But the teachings around the openness of a heart also include equanimity. And equanimity is the capacity to be at peace with good and bad, success and failure, health, good health, bad health, and so on. And it's that peace of mind which makes it rock solid. But peace of mind which hasn't got an open heart can quite often be cold, indifferent, cut off, repressed, disassociated. So the open heart, which manifests as both joy, compassion, and well-wishing, is in these teachings, is also conjoined with deep peace, deep acceptance of that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease, events are as they are. And this combination is the kind of emotional balance I think Theravada Buddhism talks about. So when we do metta practice, bring in my mom, or bring in my brother, or bring in Ajahn, whoever. And that connects me to that sense of well-wishing. But then when someone is born and dies and gets sick and has troubles, then we say, oh, yeah, life is that way. Life has this. Life has loss. And that's the kind of strength, to kind of recognize that. It's not dismissive. If it's dismissive, it has no heart. So you have both compassion to do the utmost you can to help beings, but you realize that beings also have a life. Your kids have a life, I have a life, and loss and gain are just a part of it. And that's a combination that you find, I think, like in teachers like Ajahn Chah, tremendous compassion, but also a kind of deep, peaceful coexistence with the way things are, just the way they are, rather than demanding that they be different. So do look at that, like what's the difference between sentimentality and the open heart. So the open heart it's not a verbal thing, it's a visceral, isn't it? It's when you connect to someone who, connect to someone who is happy and you are equally happy at their happiness. That's not sentimental. It's just openness. So mudita, the third of what we call the Brahmaviharas, you have metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. Metta is the sense of kindness, well-wishing to all beings. Karuna is compassion for the suffering of beings. Mudita is the joy, the gladness. And this we chanted this morning, this beautiful chant. The gladness at the success and good fortune of other beings. And gladness is also a way of looking at beauty. You know, when you look at this wall of green, it's very beautiful. I find it very beautiful, just the textures and the movement and all of that. And that's that sense of gladness that nature sometimes gives. It kind of uplifts the heart. One of the people in the interview said, so is it okay to be happy? I mean, they phrased it a different way, which is some kind of weird idea that maybe it comes from the Presbyterians in Scotland, that you can't be happy. But gladness is one of the Brahmaviharas. Gladness which is of the heart rather than just hedonistic gladness. Hedonistic gladness is when someone is like just totally excited or stoned or drunk or whatever. That's not the real gladness of the heart. That's the gladness of heedlessness. But the gladness of the heart is when you see someone who's doing well and you're sincerely happy for their happiness, beautiful. Or if you see a lovely piece like this carving behind the Buddha, just makes me very happy looking at it. Kind of gladness. I know who did it. I know all the bits and pieces. I went up to look at it while he was making it. I was here when he offered it. Da 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 da. And it's just a magnificent piece of work. So there's a kind of gladness there, isn't there? Beauty. So beauty can open the heart, can't it? Attachment to beauty means that you want one for your home. You look on eBay for one of those. But that's when it becomes greed. That's why nature, I think, is so good. You can't really own this wall of green, can you? It's just nature. So sometimes nature can really uplift the heart that way. But do contemplate, how do you open the heart to the way things are? What is the pathway for that for you? So I use, like in those meditations, I just use the natural friendships that I have and stimulate that openness of heart. And if you notice, like gladness, gratitude, compassion, it's all about the open heart, the different ways that the heart opens according to time and place. And then if you know, and you start to notice that, what is the open heart when you're relating in that way? And what is it when you feel constricted or mistrusting or critical or fearful? What's that like? I like the idea of contrast. If you see shadow, you'll see light, contrast. So if the light is like the open heart, then you'll see the shadow, where that comes from. Not that it's right or wrong, but just know how that operates, and you get an intuition of how to move perhaps more to the open heart. So I should think that the Brahmaviharas, kindness, compassion, this gladness or joy, and equanimity are the way of emotional perfection, I should say, in Theravada. And then other negative emotions, which close the heart, are things that we're trying to be aware of, not attached to. And the less we feed them, the less they influence us. They still come and go. We still feel fearful, annoyed, but they don't become a fixed habit in reality because we see them as objects. And that is to encourage the wholesome by being generous and being grateful and making gratitude conscious in the mind and noticing how beauty can affect you and open the heart. Then that becomes the momentum of the heart. And it kind of likes to go there, feels comfortable there. And so personally I find just abiding in that just that sensation here is a really nice place to put my attention, kind of better than going to thought all the time. So in the interviews one person asked that, you know, like was just talking about not feeling anything there. And so I said, well, you don't want to manufacture anything, because then that's greed. So that's what the problem. Someone says they're having this experience and then you try to manufacture it and get it and that doesn't work because it's coming from greed. So what I suggested to that person was to just if you want, if it sounds like an interesting practice, not necessary, but just to know the sensations there, just to know them, just to know what does the body feel like there with the breath and so on, just become conscious. And if you pay attention to something, then your attention will tend to go there. Like if you've been doing mindfulness of breathing at the belly, then you'll find you're eating your food and your attention will tend to go to your belly because you've just been doing it by repetition. So if one we're interested in like the sort of heart practices as a visceral feeling, then you just notice how it feels, you know, when I breathe in, I feel this. When I breathe out, I feel this. So attention just rests there. And then, as events unfold, that, what I found at least, it becomes like a more alive. It becomes more alive because I'm paying attention to it. It's rather like when we were doing a roof in Newcastle, in the monastery there, and I'd never done a roof before, and we were using slates, and so I got a bit obsessed with doing roofs and so on. So I'd been working on the roof for several weeks, and then when I went to Newcastle to teach, I remember everywhere I looked, I saw roof. Roof, roof, everywhere is roof. I never noted roof before. And that's the way it works, isn't it? What you pay attention to is what your mind is drawn to. So if you just, and this is different than manufacturing something, it's simply learning how to pay attention to a certain part of your physiognomy or whatever. So you pay attention here, and you just rest with that. This is how I evolved this, and just let it be known. Just okay, attention is there, but the desire to have, you know, you hear someone talk about a heartfelt feeling. Oh, I want that heartfelt feeling. That's no longer awareness, and that very greed to get something means you're no longer available. You're no longer available for something fresh and new. You are already preoccupied with getting something which you've heard about. You're with the memory. And so you block it. You kind of block it that way. So you become available and just abide there. Then in the course of events, what usually happens is if you get a negative kind of contraction, you'll tend to, oh, there's something going on there. Or if it's a kind of opening, you tend to notice it more. And then from that, it tends to just kind of unfold. And for me, that was very important because my practice was very cerebral, very, you know, like my dad used to say, the more you read, the more you'll know. You know, okay. And just read more and just get more doubts. And so I was kind of not very much alive from neck down. And then as I got more instruction and so on, began to do more body awareness, that became a kind of interesting place to try to explore. And then as I started to do the practices, I realized, yeah, it could be very alive there. So sometimes we're just not alive to these things because we haven't given them attention. We haven't been aware of it. It's kind of like the body itself. If you don't put any attention into the body, you only notice it when it has extreme pain. But if you start to work with it, if you do qigong or you do Tai Chi or you do yoga, you start to notice subtleties of energies and body. You become more alive in the body, as it were. Your consciousness is more in the body in that way, rather than just in thought all the time. So these practices of compassion, which I suggested early on, those are, I think they're really worth developing, getting a kind of aptitude or skill in doing them. All right, let's do some sitting practice. Again, that listening. So if I would say, listen to sound, then that's the audio part of our experience, and then just let go of sound itself. Let listening be a synonym for be aware. So this is the way it is now. Life feels this way, very simple. Like witnessing this moment, knowing. Simple language. And then from that clarity of presence, you make the intention to pick up an object of meditation or do a type of meditation. So make your intention really clear. Just this awareness or developing the heart. And then it's very much like an experiment. You're witnessing how you make effort, what kind of results you get, what kind of mood you are in now, how much energy you have. All this becomes apparent as you practice awareness. So if you have very little energy, you do deeper breathing. If you feel tense, you relax more. It's quite kind of unfolds very naturally, rather than being a fixed technique that you always do. And then you find the balance, and then maybe you find one particular thing really works for you, and you just hone that. You get better and better at it. But the goal is not to become anything, it's simply to be awake to the way things are. So it's about abandoning, relinquishing preoccupations.